Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, the podcast where we explore practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies through conversations with transplant centers and hematology-oncology practices. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. And for this episode, I was joined by Dr. Karen Ballin of University of Virginia Health and Dr. Mutul Gandhi of Virginia Cancer Specialists to discuss current research into barriers, referral patterns, and other issues that lead to differential access to care. We also explore ways to overcome these barriers and how coordinated care or shared care between transplant centers and hematology-oncology practices can help. To read bios on our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, click the link in the episode description. This is part one in a two-part discussion. All right, so Dr. Gandhi, Dr. Ballin, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today on Explore Cell Therapy. So today we're talking about referral patterns, other barriers, and overall issues with access to hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. And Dr. Ballin, I know this is an area that you've conducted some targeted research, especially in the state of Virginia, where you both practice. Can you tell me a little bit about what you've seen and what your research has shown?
Sure. Well, good morning, Sam and Mutul, and it's a pleasure to be here together. And this is my first podcast, so I'm excited to do this. So, you know, the background for the study that we did was really looking at who gets a transplant and who doesn't. Being a transplant center, obviously, we see the patients who get a transplant, but we may never interact with patients who might benefit from a transplant, but for a variety of reasons, don't have access to a transplant center or other barriers to transplant. And, you know, back in the day, the biggest barrier to transplant was finding a donor. Fortunately, today in 2022, almost everyone has a transplant donor, no matter what your background is, whether it's a family member, a donor through the Be the Match, a mismatched family member, cord blood. There's many different options for people to find donors. So I think what we're discovering is that there are other barriers to transplant besides something that might have been a barrier 10 or 20 years ago, finding a donor. So the study that we did looked at the state of Virginia, and for those people in other areas of the country, Virginia is a purple state in many ways, and the richest county in the U.S. is Loudoun County, which is in northern Virginia, the area west of D.C., where many of our elected officials may live and have their horse farms, but, you know, it's also a very diverse community. And one of the poorest areas in the country is in Southwest Virginia. That's Appalachia. It is old coal mining country. There's a high rate, unfortunately, of unemployment and substance use. And it's an area of the country where patients have very poor access to specialized healthcare. So seeing, you know, all the differences in our state, we undertook a study looking at patients who have acute myeloid leukemia, adult patients, and to determine how many of them went to transplant and if we could predict what factors might influence someone having a transplant. We didn't look at outcomes after transplant because many other studies have shown that. And we partnered with the Virginia Department of Health and also with the National Marrow Donor Program and the CIBMTR, the Bone Marrow Transplant Registry. And what we found is that in the state of Virginia for adult patients with AML of transplant age, which we defined as between ages 18 to 75, only 21% of those patients actually get a transplant. So only 21% of patients with AML who might benefit from a transplant actually have a transplant. And we wanted to really understand a little bit more about that. So we divided the state into geographic regions, and we found that if you live in Northern Virginia, your chance of getting a transplant is much higher than if you live in Southern Virginia. If you live in an area of the state that has a high African American population, and that is large parts of Southern and Eastern Virginia, you have a much lower chance of having a transplant. If you live in a community where most people do not have a college or higher level of education, you have a much lower chance of having a transplant. And then finally, we looked at something called SVI, which stands for Social Vulnerability Index. This is something that the CDC uses to look at natural disasters and what communities are at risk and need more resources. And recently, people have actually also used that for COVID. But this is the first time we've applied this index in oncology or the transplant setting to identify communities that are at higher risk. And it's a composite index that looks at educational level, ethnic and racial background, payer mix to try to determine which communities might be at higher risk. And as expected, those communities with the higher social vulnerability index, SVI, had a lower chance of their patients with AML moving towards transplant. A few other factors that we found were of interest is that those patients who had government payers, Medicare, Medicaid, also had a lower incidence of getting to transplant. And this is independent of age. And that patients who were married or had a stable partner, also had a higher chance of having a transplant. And we do know that caregiving and having a caregiver is a requirement for transplant in many transplant centers, including ours at the University of Virginia. Doesn't have to be someone that you're married to or in a stable relationship with, but you do need to have some caregiving. So those were all factors that we found influence the chance of getting to a transplant. Unfortunately, in this study, what we didn't do is come up with some solutions to those, although we did generate a few ideas, and you know, those are some things I hope that we can discuss this morning. But I think the data suggests that many patients who could benefit from a transplant, a curative therapy, regardless of having a donor, do not get to a transplant center, have access to a transplant. And I think there's room for improvement there.
Absolutely. Dr. Gandhi, what are your thoughts? Does this sort of align with your perception of some of the access issues or challenges in Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, that's a monumental effort and an impressive study because it just covers so many wide-ranging factors. And, you know, if you do retrospective analyses and large data set mining, you understand the complexity in coming up with intelligent and actionable conclusions out of there. And so even though I know Karen was saying that a solution wasn't identified, at least the facets of the problem were, which is kind of necessary to identify possible solutions. You know, I think when I step back from what she's describing a little bit further, particularly I do work in Northern Virginia. You are not privy, perhaps, to the wider swath of Greater Virginia that a tertiary care center that is a state-funded hospital is, where there is a, you know, hopefully mandate to kind of take care of the public writ large, not just pockets of the public. And so you see really the wide swath of what a complex and geographically diverse state like Virginia is. When, you know, we talk from the I don't like using the word grassroots. I think it can get misplaced a lot, but from the community oncology standpoint, I think a few things come up immediately. Community oncology has become incredibly complex, and there are tiers to it. And different tiers operate in terms of different complexity of patient care. So not all of them will take on complex hematologic patients and will necessarily get them or encourage them to go to a university center. And if there is buy-in from the physician and patient, there may be some immediate benefit just because of how vertically integrated an academic center is, where they're going to see a hematologist and then a transplant physician like Dr. Ballin. We take care of a lot of high-risk hematology, including acute myeloid and acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and Karen has transplanted a lot of my patients. What we have encountered is that there is this appetite from patients who are willing to engage and be able to get that care locally, in spite of how complex it is, provided that there's adequate ancillary services to facilitate that. But then when we begin the conversation of transplantation, usually very early on, there is a sort of a glazed look that happens. And you become cognizant that you're talking to not just the patient in front of you, but their larger family about one complex problem that is immediately pressing, and then introducing another much larger complex problem right afterwards. And that second component is not going to be delivered locally. It has to go elsewhere. And so from the very beginning, you begin to encounter some of the elements that Dr. Ballin's research merited out. Geographic issues, how close are they? Can they get there on their own? Can they get there with family? And things that maybe we don't always think about begin to really ratchet up. How many cars do they have? Do they have an extra car? Do they have an extra driver? You know, when we talk about family support, marriage or sort of partner status is important. But just because we're adult oncologists, partners may also have their own medical problems. And so do they have intergenerational support? Do their intergenerational support have the latitude from their employer to be able to take people down back and forth? And then you kind of keep going and going and going. And so you realize even among the patients that we see, all those elements that Dr. Ballin's research pointed out, you see them in real time. From our end, where we try to hopefully intervene in a way to minimize those burdens as much as possible, is get them engaged with the transplant center early and hopefully proactively start addressing those sort of things. Some of them we have solutions for, but many of them we don't. And that's the reality. Part of the other thing that, you know, we encounter when we're seeing the patient up front, and I thought the piece on education was pretty salient. We sometimes have very large families that initially is very sort of hopeful that you've got layers of support. But then what we found is that there is actually a different component, even with large families, of medical literacy being very different among different family members. And convincing them that, you know, you may need to go to a hospital 100 miles away and be hospitalized for 4 to 8 weeks at a given time, and making sure that they have the support down there. And even though you may provide a lot of assurances that there's an apparatus and an infrastructure to facilitate that, it is an iterative process to convince someone that all of that sort of legwork is necessary. So pulling back, I think we see it, what Dr. Ballin has kind of read out in the research. We see it very early on, and you get the wide swath, in spite of living in Northern Virginia, of those different elements. Not all of them are necessarily are there all together, but some more than others, and some are more amplified more than others, which are more of a, I guess, initial barrier to get people even to buy into the concept of stem cell transplantation.
Right. Yeah, no, it's no small ask, that's for sure. And there are so many pieces at play.
So, Mutul, of course, I only see the patients that elect to come to have a transplant consult. Can you describe some of the conversations that you have with patients, and what are some of the reasons that patients decide not to come for a transplant consult? Is it the risk of the procedure and medical issues, or is it some of these social, economic, other barriers?
Yeah, that's, you know, I've thought about this a little bit, in the sense that I see patients that I take on, and then ones that are kind of my partners will ask me to see, just because of the my interest in hematologic malignancies. And I think a few things come up. One is the pervading concept of what stem cell transplantation was, and there is a somewhat disconnect of what it actually is in the modern sort of era. Even amongst physicians that practice hematology oncology and that are highly experienced and very intelligent, their training experience of what stem cell transplantation was, even when I started training, is vastly different than what it is now. The morbidity and mortality rates have gone down. As Karen alluded to, there is a almost, hopefully, universal ability to get a transplant. But some of those tenets we all hold on to from training, I think I still see some physicians question, well, you know, there may not be enough donors for an African-American or an Asian-American, et cetera. And that was a pervading thought for a long, long time. Age is another one that I encounter pretty frequently. There used to be soft holds of anyone above 65. And, you know, I've sent plenty of patients that Dr. Ballin has transplanted above 70, who are obviously physically fit and their performance status is good, their organ function is good. But nonetheless, I'm after I see a patient, they may have been told, well, you're too old to obtain the next therapy. So those are the two that I see when people are referred to me, either internally or outside, that you're trying to circumvent this sort of already embedded notion that maybe this is not a modality that is available. And then, you know, the main thing that I've seen from beyond that layer is a geographic hesitation, that, you know, you have to somewhat uproot your life and be away for an X number of weeks and have some family support, and trying to kind of cobble together how that would work. We've found some of that hesitation there. And oftentimes the next question that comes up is, well, can I do just as well without the transplant? And those are things that we're working on circumventing and making sure that we have enough sort of support there. And then the third, which fortunately we found has been not as relevant for the, you know, I would say only for 10 to 20% of our patients, is a financial component. There's a lot of financial toxicity concerns, what's covered and what's not. And then we do have that smaller segment of if they have very limited government-sponsored insurance plans or uninsured patients. That's a very hard challenge.
No, absolutely. And you mentioned sort of what does it look like? I think it's kind of interesting to think about what does that path look like for a patient if they are, you know, if transplant is on the table, it's being considered, but they just can't make it happen. I mean, AML, I think, you know, the research that you did, Dr. Ballin, was in AML. is kind of a case where my understanding is transplant is kind of first line treatment, correct? Or am I mistaken?
Well, I mean, the patients would need to get chemotherapy first mm-hmm. to go into remission. And right. that is a medical barrier to transplant. If they don't go into remission, in most cases, transplant's not that successful. And so those are patients who we might not recommend to have a transplant. And then there are some types of AML that have better prognosis and don't need a transplant, but that's about 15 to 20% of patients. So depending on the patient's chromosomes and molecular genetics, the push to transplant, you know, may be higher, mid, or low, depending on what we think the chance of cure is without it. So AML, we're learning, is a very heterogeneous disease. It's not one size fits all. And there are some patients who we might feel more strongly that transplant could be benefit to them. And those are some of the medical reasons why a patient might not get to transplant if their disease doesn't go into remission or they have other serious medical problems that could be a barrier to getting through a transplant, then those might be medical reasons that they might not be able to come to transplant.
You know, to circle back, I think one question, and I've probably asked this even just in our regular exchanges, Karen, is there anything that you think that your referring providers may need to do to combat very early on some of these barriers that you would have hoped that we would have done or encouraged us to do in advance to perhaps smooth this out?
Well, I think we really enjoy working with you and your group because I think you have a very modern approach to leukemia care and you feel comfortable managing leukemia, which many oncologists don't because it's not that common a disease and not sort of bread and butter oncology. So I think, you know, just the rapid exchange back and forth, getting the patients to see us early in the disease process, one, so we can start looking for donors, but also just it takes a lot for a family to get ready for a transplant. Like you said, people may have to get time off from work. They may have to get someone from across the country to come and help out for a few weeks. They may have to reach out to family members that they may not be close to and have to decide if it's time to reengage. So there's a lot that families have to do. So I think, you know, for us, hearing about the patients early is really great. One other thing I think, not so much in access to transplant, but just even in the continuum of transplant, I think a lot of patients and families sort of get together for the transplant admission. You know, it's 3 to 4 weeks. Yes, it's 100 miles from home, but, you know, we're going to have housing for you and you can do this and that. And I've arranged it. But we know the process, that's just the start. And, you know, it can go on for years where people have medical issues related to transplant, most of which can be cared for in their community, but some might need an eye graft versus host disease specialist or a skin specialist. And so I think that part, I think, is very hard to explain to patients because people, of course, they think about what's the next step and not, well, what could happen in 6 months or 12 months. One thing we decided to do, we were talking about this as a team, is to pair up patients considering a transplant with someone who's had one, and maybe not just someone who's where it's been really like smooth sailing, but someone who may have had some challenges. And some of your patients, Matula, volunteered to do this. And I think that's been really helpful. And in the pandemic, something that can be done on the phone and, you know, obviously with both parties willing to do it. So I think that's way that patients can help each other to understand better the process and to help patients prepare for the process.
Yeah, I think that second part is very informative and instructive. I distinctly remember, you know, on my fellowship transplant service, one of the things we would do is have these long-term transplant survivors come and walk the halls and, where permissible, talk to these patients who are really in the throes of it. And I think that was paramount, just to offer that sort of sense of, all right, there is a valuable destination that is achievable for going through all of this. And even before that, I think this sort of engagement of people who have gone through it helps. I think even when you tease it down more, and sometimes it's hard to link this, but even having someone of the same either socioeconomic strata or demographic or racial strata, there is something that is gained that's difficult to calculate or put, you know, parameters around when you hear someone you think is like you who has successfully gone through it. And yeah, I love that our patients are able to be able to pay that forward. I think that's been really helpful.
Thanks for taking the time to listen today. Join us next time on Explore Cell Therapy for the second half of this important discussion, where our guests dive into health equity, coordinated or shared care, and other potential solutions to help overcome barriers to transplant.